This episode is sponsored by Kendo UI. Kendo UI allows you to build better apps faster. They have a comprehensive library ranging from data grids and charts to buttons and sliders. Plus, you can use their components as plain JavaScript as well as in Angular, React, and Vue. They have a large collection of customizable popular themes like Bootstrap and Material. Go check them out at reactroundup.com/KendoUI. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of React Roundup. This week on our panel, we have Kent C. Dodds.
Hey, hey.
Nander Davitt.
Hello.
Corey House.
Hi there, everybody.
I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv. And this week, we have a special guest, and that is David Atchley. David, do you want to say hi?
Hello.
Do you want to give us just a brief introduction? Let us know who you are, why you're famous, all that stuff.
Oh, well, I don't know about famous, but yeah. So I've been doing software development for 24 years. I've been mostly in web development for the last 10 to 15 or so, and playing around with React. I've worked at a couple of startups, some large companies, so I'm sort of all over the place, but mostly doing client work through a company that is a sub company that I started with my parent company out here called Tandemly, just outside of St. Louis.
Cool. Well, we brought you on today to talk about breaking up higher order functions. And Corey pointed out before the show that we've kind of talked about this to some degree, but do you want to just frame the conversation kind of how you think about it, and then we can jump off from there?
Yeah. I mean, so higher order components, it's just like
higher order components. I said functions, didn't I?
You've got a function that wraps another function and returns a whole new function for you. So that it works the same way with components, right? So we're basically creating a component that takes another component, modifies it a bit, adds some props to it, and then returns a whole new component for you to use. So that's the higher order component part of that. And then render props basically decouples those two. So instead of having a function take another function or a component take a component, we're basically decoupling that and writing a component that takes a single function as a prop. And that function is then responsible for rendering whatever components you want using whatever state props variables you want to pass to it through that single function. And that's really the pattern that is render props.
So I just want to call out the fact that higher order component is actually a misnomer. It's an incorrect name. It's what we call it, but it's supposed to be patterned after the higher order function, like you said, David. the thing that it returns is a component. The thing that you are calling is what we call the higher order component. So like connect from React Redux or with router from React Router. That function is what we are calling the higher order component. But that thing is neither a component nor is it higher order because it's a function that's returning a component. But I think that's like the crux of things to understand is that it's just this function that can create components, as you said, David. And there are lots of examples of these in the wild. So like I said, React Router has one. Redux has one. There's styled components and Glamorous and Emotion. All of these are using higher order component functions. They're just factories that are creating these components for you. And there are just tons of examples of these. David, do you want to talk a little bit about what are some of the use cases for higher order components, or are you suggesting that maybe we just only need render props when we want to share code? What's your position on that?
So I read a lot before I started getting into render props on my own code. I was reading, of course, a lot from the React Router folks, so Ryan Florence and Michael Jackson, and their use of them. But really, the fact that you can use a render prop anywhere that you could use a higher order component, and the fact that you can do that alone isn't really enough to do that. The reason that I like the render prop pattern is because it's much more explicit and declarative when I'm actually trying to build a component and pull functionality out. If I have a component that I want to render that has a specific function, then I don't want to inundate that component with sort of slices of things that aren't within its context, right? It has one specific purpose. It's going to render a button. It's going to render a card, right? It shouldn't have to deal with sort of aspect-oriented programming concepts that I want to shove into it by wrapping it in HOCs multiple times over. So the HOCs sort of build those components for you statically at compile time. And using a render prop, I can take care of that dynamically at render time, and I've got much more flexibility when I'm using that render prop or function as a child.
So is there a situation where you'd say, like, well, just taking a specific example, like Redux, like if you were, like, would you suggest not using the connect higher order component and maybe writing a render prop instead for using and consuming state in Redux?
You could actually try that. I've played around with it a little bit just in CodePen and other places, but you could easily take something like Redux and make it work using a higher order, I mean, a render prop. Because really, you're just, all Connect is doing is mapping state to props and some other things for you and then passing it down to your component. You could do the same thing and make those all available in a much simpler fashion through a render prop, but that doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't use an HOC. I don't think HOCs are going away. I don't think that it's one over the other. I think that it depends on how you're organizing your code, how you're organizing your components. There's always trade-offs with any pattern. And I think the teams that are trying to determine which way to go just need to take a look at that and determine what's the right one for them.
I just want to call that out, say it again, double testify, whatever you want to call this. I totally am on board with the idea of think critically about the abstractions that you're using. Don't be dogmatic about any of these things. So for me, like there are already a bunch of libraries that are React as a render prop thing. In fact, in my advanced React patterns course on Egghead, I show you how to create a React consumer that's a consuming via render prop. And it's great, but it's actually like, I think that it's worse. It makes things a little bit more verbose in unnecessary ways. And so, the idea that a render prop can totally replace a higher order component is totally true. There's nothing you can do with the HOC that you can't do with the render prop. But you need to consider the ergonomics of these APIs. And I think thinking critically about what are the problems that these patterns solve, and do I have those problems, and then how does that that solution to this problem compare to alternative solutions? And in my opinion, if you're using React Redux, the higher order component for Connect is definitely better than a render prop version of the same thing, because one of the big differences between higher order components and render props is that, like you said, David, render props allow for dynamic composition, whereas HOCs are static. But the HOC that React Redux provides gives you functions that you can pass to it for all the dynamic capabilities that you would want anyway. So you just pass your map state to props or whatever. And all that dynamic stuff happens within that function, then it'll give you a component that just kind of wraps all that up together for you. One other thing that I'm not a huge fan about higher order components is that when you use them, you're making an entirely different component. And I don't like having to create names for things.
Right.
It's like super annoying. So like with React Redux, you normally create your component and then you export default connect your component. And if we didn't do the if we were going to give a name to that thing, then we would like just say connected whatever the other name was, and that's kind of useless. And in the React dev tools, it's just another layer in the component tree. So I generally kind of like to lean toward render props for that reason. But anyway, I just to get back to my original point, I think it's really important for teams to think critically about the patterns that they're using and the problems that those things are solving, and compare alternatives. There's not one pattern that manages every or solves every single problem the best way always.
Yeah, I think when I looked through the React Redux code before on GitHub early on, in its development, I think it actually was built with a render prop. And then they went to the HOC style after that. There was some discussion on the GitHub issues about that if you dig into the history. So that was an interesting factoid when I was looking into who's using render props, who's not.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. If you can dig up where that is, that'd be cool. That's the cool thing about these patterns is that you can actually use them together. And so I always suggest people, if they think that somebody would ever want to have the flexibility of a render prop, then definitely, but like most people want an HOC or something, definitely build the render prop and then build an HOC out of that render prop component. Because it's so much easier. You can't do the other way. You can't make an HOC and then make a render prop out of that. It doesn't work. But you can do make an HOC out of a render prop component. So I totally recommend if you want to share code, first make your render prop component and then make your HOC on top of that. I think that's a pretty solid way to do that.
See, I'm actually using render props and a sort of a side project I'm doing right now, writing a survey, but I'm basically taking a component, which is a survey provider and a survey consumer. And that survey provider basically feeds context down to the survey consumer. And then the survey consumer is written using a render prop, letting me render pretty much any component I want, grabbing information about where in the survey the user is actually at that point. So that's common use case that I'm using it for right now.
Yeah, totally. That's a great use case. Have you looked into the new context API from React?
Oh, I'm very excited about the new context API.
Do you want to tell us about it a little bit, Dave?
I've only looked at a couple of things, given I don't have my hands on 16.3 yet. But yeah, I mean, the fact that you're basically building providers and consumers is a good abstraction for that. And that lets you basically wrap any section of code in a provider and then write specific or non-specific consumers that you can then wrap code that's a child sections of those to grab context from wherever you'd like. I think it's a cleaner way to pass context and to use context to compose the pages that you're doing with React.
And I will say that was a good description of it. I am excited to see the context API, but I also have concerns about misuse with any tool. I've liked for a long time that the context API has been considered a power tool that regular developers shouldn't touch. I've considered it a feature that they said, hey, the API may change at some point, use at your own risk. My concern is the same thing that has happened with Redux, which is overuse. Mm-hmm. And I find developers love to find a pattern that works everywhere rather than thinking about the nuance, especially people that are new to a technology. And this is why, I mean, for instance, we've known for years that global variables are something to be avoided. But if you show someone a way to effectively declare global variables in React, which is what context effectively gives you, you can get your data wherever you want it. My concern is, will people overuse that? And I suspect in the same way, like when I'm teaching people React, one thing that I typically don't talk about is refs, because my thought is when you need a ref, you'll really know it. But I don't want you to even have it in your head confusing you about whether you should use a ref in that case, because, again, it's sort of it's a power tool for more of the edge cases. Do you guys share my concerns, and do you have any thoughts on how we help people avoid overuse and misuse of this now standardized context feature?
Yeah, I kind of agree. Hopefully people will kind of voice their opinion, kind of like how you just have, kind of talking about that it may be a good use case for like building your own libraries and things like that, but probably you're not going to need it in your day-to-day work. I know that a really good abstraction over the new context API that is possibly a replacement or an option for Redux is unstated by, I forgot who actually wrote the library now, but
that's
sure
James Kyle.
Yeah, James Kyle. So unstated kind of like takes advantage of the new context API and allows you to build like a state management without having to pass the context down yourself, without having to kind of build all of this out yourself. It's already kind of like there in a library for you. And it's pretty nice. And it's really in my opinion, it makes a lot more sense than a lot of the other things that are out there. So hopefully, like, when people do stuff like that, they'll kind of say, hey, this is a good use of the context API, but I wouldn't kind of just throw it in my application to declare it global.
I think a lot of it comes back to sort of what Ken mentioned before, is it's dogma, right? So as developers, we've been taught for decades that, oh, when you write code, make it as reusable as possible. So people start off at the highest level of abstraction. And I think that the way you stop people from, or the way that you encourage people to stop adopting things as dogma, because it comes out either a pattern or a library like Redux, which has just become overused, is you say, start developing those components in that code at the local level. Don't start thinking globally when you build a button component. Don't think about the 14 other people that may potentially use that button. Your app is going to use that button. So write the button for that app. And as you need an abstraction, as you need to make something more generally available, then move to that. That's like, start with local state and React and understand that before you start using Redux. There's no need to just throw Redux in right off the bat if you've got a 3-page app that does, you know, 6 things total. So I think it's about keeping people's expectations at the local level and only thinking global and moving to higher level abstractions absolutely when it's needed.
I couldn't agree with you more, David. I want to give you a high five on your comments. I'm actually giving a talk tomorrow at the React Dev Summit. So when everybody's listening to this, it's already happened. But my talk is called How to React. And that's a big part of my talk is don't pre-optimize for code reuse. You should be optimizing for deletability. And so like keeping things localized is a really good way to accomplish that. And just using abstractions when they're absolutely needed and not before. So to get back to Corey's original question, I did have a couple of thoughts. So Corey's concerned about context overuse. I can guarantee you that's going to happen. Pendulum swing, especially in the React community, I've noticed the pendulum swings really hard. And we'll come back and the difference, I think, and one of the things that I'm really excited about with the context API is that the association between the provider and consumer is explicit. And so before, with the context API, you had to you'd have this like magic string that identified your context in the tree. And now you say react.createContext, it gives you back an object that has a provider and a consumer. And then if you want to access whatever that provider is providing, you have to use that consumer. And so if you're looking at some code that's using that consumer, you can actually trace the imports and find exactly where that context was created in the first place. And so I think that's a really nice aspect and a feature, I guess, of the new context API, is that things are much more explicit. So while it is technically kind of a global variable in a sense, it's actually not all, it's not as concerning to me as a global variable would be.
Yeah, that is a good point. The API has been designed in such a way that that it does help avoid some of the concerns that I have there. I think the interesting thing is that the more ways that we present for someone to solve a problem, the more that beginners do want to reach for the one that works everywhere. And that's precisely why I had the concerns about the context overuse, is there's this recognition of, okay, well, I could just put everything over here in one spot and then context all the things. And I've seen people do the same thing with Redux. If there's one common pattern that I've seen in my consulting, is people say, hey, we're frustrated by how much pain we're feeling in Redux by having to always create all these actions and these reducers and passing all this data around. And then I come to see that every form field is, every keystroke is running through a Redux action, and they're keeping their form state over there in Redux. And those sorts of things don't add value and really create a lot of friction there. So there's this feeling that, hey, we have to choose one pattern and use that pattern consistently. So as developers, I think we're very drawn toward the systematizing things. And that can also drive us toward the overuse of whatever tool we've learned. So people early on in React, I think it's I guess I'm questioning right now, as somebody that teaches React a lot, I'm leaning toward continuing to not bring up context for beginners and let beginners get comfortable. And then when they really do have the problem, they can find out about context. Or if we're doing a more advanced course, dive into that. How do you guys feel about that? Do you feel like it's a kind of along the lines of ref, the ref feature, for instance, where you do wait for a while to introduce people to it because of the potential for confusion and misuse?
I mean, I've done quite a bit of teaching over the last year and a half with React Native, and it's very similar to React and when you're teaching it, because you're really just teaching React in any way along with the React Native APIs. Sure. We usually go into context when we go into Redux, because when we first talk about Redux, I found it very helpful for the developers to kind of understand what's going on under the hood. But like you said, with refs, like we talk about it, like this library uses it, you shouldn't use it unless it's a very, you know, a very rare circumstance when you will need it. And another thing about the React community, which is a good and a bad thing, I guess, when it comes to like new stuff, when it comes out, everybody and their mother wants to jump on it and talk about it and create blog posts and tweet about it. And then they want to like maybe create like a snippet where they did some crazy stuff like with this new feature, which is good again, but it's also kind of bad because a lot of people aren't going to disclaimer like, you know, this probably like is a rare use case. Like in my company, like this thing we just did, like is necessary, but in reality, you could probably get by without doing all this complex. And I think it's something that like the React community seems to love to do. Like I look at code all the time, and it's really cool to see like new ways of doing things. But 90% of the time, people are doing things just to kind of show that they can be done, which again is really awesome because like, oh, I get an idea. But as a beginner, if I looked at this code, I would be completely lost and like confused and also maybe not understand when I should do one thing, whereas when I shouldn't do that thing, you know?
Do you run your own freelance business? Or maybe you're thinking about picking up some business on the side. Well, then you need FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the quickest and easiest way to get invoices out to your clients. It's easy to use. It works anywhere, available from any device, on the desktop, iPhone, iPad, Android, and all of your data is backed up and secure. And it makes it really easy to get organized and get paid. You'll be tracking time, logging expenses, and invoicing your clients in no time. You can also save time billing, freeing up several days per month to focus on the work that you love, and you get paid faster. FreshBooks customers are paid on average 5 days faster because there's a link on the invoice that says pay me now. And it's a great way to grow your business. Plus, FreshBooks is offering a 30-day trial. That's right, 30-day trial if you try them out. So go to gofreshbooks.com/devchat and enter devchat in the how did you hear about us section. Once again, for a 30-day trial, go to gofreshbooks.com/devchat and enter devchat in the how did you hear about us section.
With the context, it's, I think maybe you introduce context at a point where it becomes, again, one of those necessary abstractions, right? So maybe you're teaching a course or you're walking them through putting an app together and they've created a component where they're managing some state that they want to pass down to other child components, but then they determine that those child components, they want to give the user of those components the ability to lay them out more flexibly. And so then it's, well, how do we want to continue explicitly passing state as props down to these child components continuously like a waterfall? Or at this point, how about context? Context lets us set this state up internally and then make it available to whichever component chooses to grab that child context from below. So I think it's a matter of introducing it absolutely when it's needed, but have them do it the other way first to find out why that's handy.
Yes. Yes. This is so good, David. So I actually do have an intro to React course, and this subject would definitely not make it into the first day. There are way too many other things that you'd want to teach first. Whenever I would teach it, the first thing I would do before I got to that point was I'd say, okay, let's do some prop drilling. Like I wouldn't tell them that's what we're going to experience, but I would make them experience the pain that is prop drilling and then have them move a component over from one place to another. And now you have to go update all these other components that didn't even care about those props. Right. And so like that is the pain that we're solving with context. And until you feel that pain, you want to understand the value of context, and then you want to be able to appreciate the cost of context either. And so with that, you won't be able to properly assess whether context is worth the cost. And so, yeah, totally on board with David there too. I think it would be very important for people to understand and feel the pain of missing context. There are so many apps that you could just build with like basically no libraries, no Redux, and no advanced features from React. Because like React itself just comes with, you know, just the set state API comes like gives you pretty much everything that you need for most applications. And it's only when they get to a certain point of prompt drilling pain that you need something like context like any sort of really complex state interactions that you need something like unstated. And so, yeah, I think it's really important for especially beginners to focus on the core API first, because then they'll be able to leverage these other abstractions more effectively.
Yeah, I totally agree, Kent. And I mean, I learned this lesson the hard way too. So at Cox Automotive, my team supports effectively a framework that is an opinionated way about how we do React. And our framework has Redux built in the box. And when we put it in there, we also put in a little example app just showing our opinions about here's how we name reducers, here's how we put our action creators, here's how we initialize the store and how we declare that state. Just effectively wanting to show people a lot of examples along the way. But what I didn't realize by doing that was I was also inferring to people that you need Redux, start with Redux. And that, and I tweeted this out a while back, and unfortunately, I felt like a lot of people took it as me saying, don't use Redux, because I just said the mistake that I made was putting that into our framework by default, because I didn't realize that people would read that as I should always have this in my application, and this is the way I should think about using React. And some of the ripple effects that came from that, I didn't see coming, because we saw other teams that would create reusable components, and those reusable components would assume that Redux was part of whatever application they were being used in. And in fact, we saw people going, okay, and here's how we're going to interact with the reducers, and here's how we take actions. And I just go, wait, no. If we're sharing React components, they shouldn't have an opinion about Redux or MobX or any of these things. We've got to peel back. And that order of learning and what you talked about of feeling the pain first, because if you haven't felt the pain, then you assume that you always use this tool, but you don't really understand why you're taking the medicine. You're just taking the medicine because some smart person said that was a good idea, I guess. And I've been as guilty of it as anyone else. But I think this is the hard part where we're at right now. As React grows, React starts to have some of the same struggles that Angular has had through the years, where there's multiple ways to do the same thing. And understanding which way to do it requires a fair amount of scar tissue from going, yeah, I felt pain when I was past the prop drilling, for instance. So we as educators have to use some of this knowledge to be very careful about the order that we present things and the way that we also present examples, I think, in our own companies as we create frameworks and libraries around this.
Yeah, the thing that I've struggled with working with clients that are using React and Redux together from that standpoint of taking things as dogma, like the context issue, is really around Redux, and everything should be in Redux. So there is no local component state, right? So you get this argument about, oh, well, if you're using Redux, everything goes in Redux. Everything becomes global application state. There is no local state anymore, right? And they had also run into the issue where they were writing reusable components that were connected and expecting other people to use them, which presupposes how you've got your global state set up or reducers that you need to have on hand and how you name those things. And it becomes problematic. I think you have to get past that dogma. You have to get past, oh, we have to use this because we're using Redux, or we have to do it this way because we're using HOCs or render props or whatever the pattern might be, and move ahead from there. Start simple, work up.
So kind of on this topic, I'm just curious, when you guys start a new application, I'm assuming that you start with just plain React, right? Or do you want to look at the whole scope of the project and say, I can tell looking at the scope, we're going to hit a scope that justifies me reaching for Redux, for instance. Do you guys try to get to that level up front? David, is that something that you do?
I work with a bunch of different companies and that are clients of ours. And I've seen those companies approach it both ways. But the way that I always recommend is to start off with just React. Don't make any assumptions about what you're going to use from a global state perspective or what type of global state you need or what shape it needs to be in. Start small, right? And I sort of crossed the boundary with design and product design as well as development. And it's sort of the lean philosophy of designing products in the first place. What's the minimal feature functionality this application needs that we need to take care of right now? And what's the simplest way to do that that's least resistance that lets us get it out there, get it tested, get it in front of users? And that's almost always, from a development standpoint, going with fewer dependencies, starting simple, and building it up from there.
I pretty much never use Redux on anything else. My last team, we were using Redux. Lots of teams at PayPal use Redux. And we just started a rewrite of one app that was in like very, very old stuff. And the business could like invest in a rewrite. So like I'm justifying the rewrite thing because I normally don't recommend rewrites. But anyway, we kind of started this thing fresh. And we're not going to be using Redux. We're using Unstated, and we love it. It's amazing. And we're like just using it for the bare minimum of stuff. But I'm kind of on board with what David's suggesting, and I wanted to just add that like at all times you should be optimizing for deletability, because things change so much. Like your requirements are going to change. Your like everything will change. So if you optimize for scaling this app up to, millions of developers working on it all together and everything, you're going to wind up with something that's way complicated. And then all the requirements are going to change and all of that stuff doesn't matter anymore. And now because it's not optimized for deletability, you have to retrofit the new requirements into what you've built, like the huge framework that you built around what you expected that you would need in the first place when you don't actually need that anymore. And that said, I normally... if I need more than like a couple URLs, like more than two, literally, I will be bringing in React Router. I don't want to deal with managing history or any of that stuff. So React Router is in most of the apps that I write, whether they be small or big. And now if I am going to have any application state that changes, then I'm going to be using Unstated. It's just such a great solution for that. Also provides a render prop API, kind of bringing us back to the original topic of the discussion. So it gives you a great amount of flexibility. And then you can build your own stuff around that as well. So that's kind of my approach.
Yeah, I mean, still just going back a second on my, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm in the Midwest. Not to knock companies in the Midwest necessarily, but most of the ones I've worked with out here tend to be, if they're adopting React and Redux or any of those technology, the frameworks that's sort of the forefront right now with the web, they tend to be really, really dogmatic about how they do it. So they'll have these giant ESLint rule files and these other draconian rules set up, don't use inline functions and always do connected components and everything is in global state. And it becomes really hard to manage, really hard to deal with. And the thing that I find hardest working with them is convincing them that that's the wrong path, right? How do you tell them that, this is really just dogma? You're telling me inline functions aren't performant, but you're not measuring anything. So how do you even know? How do you stop that? I'd like to know.
Yeah, David, I love what you said there because I've dealt with the same pain. And I can't tell you how many times I've come onto teams who have paid me to come in and help them understand Redux. And I spend a lot of my time explaining why they probably shouldn't be using it on the project that they're using, at least not yet. Or I see people that are having pain from Redux, and I realize, well, the reason you have pain is you're using a tool that is overkill. You're cutting paper with an axe here. You just don't have enough complexity to justify this weight. But I mean, I also like the, what I was thinking about was you mentioned Midwest, and obviously I'm a Midwestern guy. I'm here in Kansas City, and ASP.NET is very big in the Midwest, in particular in Kansas City. And a lot of the reason that it is very popular is, at least in the Midwest, we seem to really like having strongly opinionated frameworks that tell us what we do. And that was where early on, I felt like I was the only person in town that liked React, because everybody else was going, no, obviously you use Angular. Of course you use Angular. Because Angular, again, when it came to opinions, Angular had all this comprehensive opinion, and React was over here going, it's cool, do what you want. I'm solving one little problem. And I think that's part of what has made Redux so attractive to people, was it injected a whole lot of opinion and pattern. And in the same way, when I saw React really take off in the Midwest and really everywhere, was, you know, once Create React App came out and everybody went, oh, okay, so this is how you do React development. Now we have an opinion. Now I'm not spending my time trying to decide between Browserify and Webpack and Rollup and all of these other decisions. So and that very mindset is also what tends to drive us toward overuse again. But I don't know. I don't know how much what we're talking about is a Midwestern specific thing. I think just a lot of developers, especially early on in my career, I totally appreciate it. Or really early on, whenever I pick up something new, I'm going, I don't want to do it wrong. So just tell me the way to do it. Tell me the right thing to use. And then at least I won't feel like I'm totally blowing it. So later, yeah, there may be better ways to go, but good enough is fine by me. I'm rambling, but I appreciated what you said. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure it occurs elsewhere. My experience is in the Midwest and the South. So given my limited data set.
So I had a question going back to our original topic of discussion about render props. So one thing one criticism I've seen a lot about render props is the amount of nesting in your render function. If you compose more than two or three render prop consumers or render prop components, your JSX is going to, it's like people will reference the Pyramid of Doom, from callbacks of Node from before. Makes your code a little harder to maintain. So what are your thoughts there, David, on the nesting of multiple render prop components?
Yeah, so too, right? Nesting, multiple nesting levels is always bad no matter what the pattern or use case. So you want to try to avoid it. If you overuse the pattern, it's going to look like callback hell. And you definitely want to avoid that. But one way to do that is to, instead of basically inlining the output of that render function or render prop, is to create a separate component and simply just pass that component. That's one way to do it, right? The other is to think about how you're building the app itself, and do you need to do it in nested layers? Maybe there's a different way to organize that and create providers and consumers that works better, so that you don't get that nesting. But I think there's a number of ways around that. But you also see it on the HOC side, right? So if I go into a component file and that component is connected to Redux, it's also got a form in it, so it's got Redux form and maybe one or two other HOCs wrapped around it. When I get to the bottom of that file and look at what it's exporting, that's just as hard to read as nested render prop functions. So it's the trade-off.
Yeah, so I totally agree. I'm a little less concerned about nested JSX. I think it's a little different from nested callbacks, where you have context from previous callbacks, and now you have like clashing variables, and oh, don't forget to handle the error from your callback and stuff. With JSX, there's a little bit less concern there from my standpoint, but in cases where like it is super nested, there, like you said, making your own component that like handles all those, and then you just have one layer of nesting. There's also like built, there are components already in existence to compose those together. And so you just have this one component, you pass like a components array of all the render prop components, and then you get a single render prop, like children function, that will pass you an array of all of the values from those render prop components. And so I'll have to find it for you. But yeah, it seems to make sense a lot to me. And with the context API being a render prop component, there's this interesting tweet that I'll share in the show notes from this guy named Eteni. I'm not sure how to say it, but it was on Twitter. He tweeted a higher order component called Combined Context that gives you back a context consumer-like component that will kind of combine all these different sources of context. It's kind of interesting. It's a higher order component that gives you back a component that's a render prop component. But I think that this is a pretty simple solution. That's what I like about React in general, is that the solutions are just more JavaScript. There's nothing like fancy or weird that you have to do to simplify some of these things. It's like, you don't like what this block of code is doing, well, take that block and put it into a function. And then that's just a little abstraction that you set off to the side to make your usage of stuff more clean. So anyway, I'll find a link to these things. I have a blog post called Common Questions About Render Props, where I reference that, and I'll give you a link to that too.
Yeah, I just found the GitHub issue that was talking about React Redux Connect being a render prop. I'll paste that up here in the chat. We can share that out as well.
Actually, you know what? One thing we should probably cover is performance. This is like, people are always ragging on the render prop pattern for performance. And so, yeah, maybe we should talk about that for a sec. What thoughts do you have, David?
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes back to the don't prematurely optimize, right? Write your code naturally the way you would normally write it. And then once you start seeing a performance problem, that's when you can start determining what you need to measure to find out where that problem is. I think Ryan Florence had a good article talking about inline functions and the previous now solved issues of, you know, function.bind, which a lot of people alluded to when they started talking about inline function performance. But I just don't think those really exist. And when you do find those, if you measure for them and determine which components are causing that, you can always pure component or should component update to solve a lot of those problems. But in my work, I haven't really encountered any clients that end up having performance problems because of inline functions. It's always something else that's causing a problem.
Yeah, totally. And even like, you go ahead and measure, and if you find out, oh man, like having an inline function is breaking my pure component, and I need that pure component to, you know, for X reason. After you've measured and you found out that's the problem, then actually it's really easy to just take that little inline render prop function, make it a member property of your class, like using public class fields, and now you just reference it and it's no longer breaking your pure component. So it's like a solution with just using JavaScript. I love React. It's just JavaScript. But that's a question that I get like all the time about render props. Like, what about performance? What about performance?
Well, I mean, do they experience the same thing in the Angular community? I played with Angular when it was 1.x era. But I think, sort of like you alluded to, React is really just JavaScript, right? It's not opinionated, kind of like we were talking about. And so with something like Angular, where it's everything in the kitchen sink, it's very opinionated about how you organize your code, how you write that, what are the patterns to use. And with something like React, where it's not opinionated at all, I think we probably in the community have more discussions surrounding, oh, what is the right way, the wrong way? That's where dogma sort of builds up. And I don't think you get that in some of the other framework communities like Angular.
Yeah, totally. Because the solution has to come from the framework anyway. It's like, oh, this template syntax is missing a feature. There's not really, like, there's no churn on, like, how do we solve this? Because the solution is impossible without some change to the template syntax or something like that. I mean, Angular is a lot more just JavaScript now than it was before when I was using it as well with Angular 1. But still, there, just the fact that it's a template means that you have a lot less flexibility with how you can solve certain problems.
I think it's a good conversation. I'm not aware of what was covered in a previous episodes about render props, but they're really simple. There's not much to them.
Yeah, actually, when I'm teaching render props, I have a component that is doing something and it has a render function. It's rendering something, and I say, now what if I wanted to customize this render function? Well, I could pass some props and I could do if else and stuff. But what if I just took this render function and I moved it as part of like a class definition, and I just say this dot, you know, render stuff, and then okay, so now let's turn that function into a pure function. So now it's this dot render stuff, and then I pass my state and my props and whatever that pure function needs, and then I say okay, let's actually, now that it's a pure function, it doesn't need to be on the class anymore. Let's pull it off the class, and now it's, you know, instead of this dot, it's just like render stuff and pass my props and state. And it's like, okay, well now I like, what if I pass this as a prop instead of referencing that function? And so it's a very, like, through that step by step, it becomes a very clear, like what's going on becomes very clear. And I think that's one of the things that I like about the render prop pattern is it just takes, like jumping from step one to the last step of render props, maybe a little bit of a jump, but there you just take a couple of steps between and it becomes a lot more clear what's going on. Render props are pretty simple.
So have you guys encountered differences with people trying to use render props versus component injection, where instead of passing a function, they just want to pass a component?
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that. There's this, my friend, oh, now I'm blanking on his name. I'll find his name and I'll mention it because he's a nice guy. But he is from American Express, and he is like always talking about how awesome the component injection is. I am of the opinion that component injection is less flexible than render props, and so because it requires that you create a component, and that component is going to be in your React tree as well. And so...
Well, that's not even opinion. That's just fact. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah.
So,
you don't have to hedge.
So the argument for it is that, like, okay, well, with component injection, I can have lifecycle methods and stuff with whatever I'm passing in. That's nice. But the fact is that with render props, you can also have lifecycle methods. Just your inline function just renders a component, and that thing has lifecycle methods. But I found that most of the time, I don't care about the lifecycle methods anyway. So it ends up performing better if we care about performance, which we probably don't, but that's just a cherry on top. And then just the API, to, like I said earlier, I don't like naming things. If I don't have to name something and like it's not really valuable, like if you have a name where it's, you know, wrapper or container, that is clear that that's what that thing is. You don't need to give it a name called wrapper or container. Like that's a useless name. It's just noise. And so I try to avoid those kinds of things. And by having to create, and this is another one of the reasons I mentioned earlier why I'm not a huge fan of higher order components too, is it forces you to create a component and you have to name that thing. And I prefer to avoid that if the name isn't necessary. So the nice thing with render props is you can give it a name if you want to, but you don't have to. With component injection, you have to give it a name and it's going to be mounted as opposed to a render prop where it's just a function that you call, return some JSX.
Right.
Although, Kent, I would say, I mean, I'm a fan of component injection. And I think what's interesting is render props is a more flexible pattern. And you said that, and I completely agree with you, because it is, again, it's just fact. But we do have to be clear about what we're losing there. I was thinking about this in terms of my OO history, and you guys have heard about the solid principles. And one of the solid principles is the open closed principle, where it's open for extension but closed for modification. If you think about the component injection pattern, you can have this finite set, and I've got five particular components here, and maybe I've got a switch statement over here that determines which one is depending on props passed in, whatever it may be. And those five components really close for modification. And if we find out we have a sixth type that we need to deal with, we go create that new one. And the only line of code that we really touch here is the code that determines which one gets instantiated and passed down. So I think part of the decision comes down to, is it realistic for you to have that finite list? Because I think everybody here agrees that the component injection pattern is useful. But the thing that caught me a little bit odd was when you said, well, I prefer the render props pattern. Well, I guess what you're really saying is, in your experience, more often than not, you need that level of configuration. If you were to try to write the finite list of components that you needed, they wouldn't provide a significant, or they wouldn't provide you sufficient flexibility. You would find yourself needing to move all the way there. And I guess in my experience, I found the component injection pattern to be useful, and I feel like it doesn't get as much attention as it probably deserves. So I was glad it came up on here, and I didn't even think to bring it up, but I appreciate it. I guess, David, was that you that mentioned it in the first place?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That. And I don't know why that is. Maybe because Kent's really good at making things popular, so render props is popular. But I mean,
React Router did component injection for the route components at one point, didn't it?
Yeah, it still does. Supports that. You have a component prop and you have a render prop.
Right.
You also have a children prop, and that will always be rendered. It's kind of interesting and confusing. I wanted to make sure I mentioned the man who's been pushing component injection so hard is Donovan West. He's a great guy. Really has a strong opinion that render props are inferior to component injection, and I have a pretty strong argument against his opinion, but he's a nice person, so we like each other still.
Yeah, I actually recall reading the PR that Michael Jackson put in to add render props to the React docs, and they were having a conversation back and forth, which was very entertaining to read. Yeah, the other way that I use render props too, that I mentioned in my article on Medium, is that it doesn't always have to be just, oh, function is the child, it's going to render that, or a single render prop, you just render that, right? So if I'm writing a component that needs to render multiple other child components, but potentially at different locations, and I want to give the caller control over those, I can pass multiple props that are render props. Right. So in the example I give in the article, it's a navigation bar where you have a left side, a right side, and a brand, and each of those is a render prop. So you can pass any function you want to render whatever you want, and then the component itself, the parent component, decides where to call your render prop function in the right location so that your content gets rendered in the correct spot. So that's another way to use that, is having multiple render props on a component to help give the user some control of what things are going to look like, what gets rendered, how they're styled, and you handle the placement of those with inside the parent component.
Yeah, and actually, React Select version 2 does something similar to that, except instead of render props, they're using component injection. But so they're still in charge of the layout, like where does the input get rendered, where do the options get rendered, all of that responsibility is still the responsibility of React Select. But they allow you to specify what component gets rendered at those locations. And so, yeah, if you do want to be opinionated about layout, then you can still provide some flexibility with regard to like what gets rendered at specific locations in the layout.
Yeah, I think I came across that pattern initially, multiple render props, with one of the materialized React libraries. I don't remember if it was React Toolbox or Materialize UI, one of those. They use the same sort of a pattern where you would pass multiple render props, each of which would contain a function to render the component you wanted at that particular location for that particular piece of the UI. It'd be cool if we had a call-in line and people could ask questions.
Anyway, let's go ahead and do some picks.
For you, Loot Crate is offering an opportunity to save 10% on any new subscription at lootcrate.com. Just enter the promo code BRIDGE10 for 10% savings. Loot Crate is one of my favorite things. Every month I get a box in the mail, costs less than $20, and it comes with all kinds of goodies. I have stuff from just looking at my shelf, Batman, Spider-Man, Ninja Turtles, Back to the Future, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, and much, much more. So if you're a geek, a gamer, anything like that, and you want cool stuff to put around your office, cool t-shirts, comic books, etc., then definitely check out Loot Crate. To save 10% on your new subscription, go to lootcrate.com/ruby. Again, that's lootcrate.com/ruby to save 10% on any new subscription. Enter the promo code BRIDGE10 for 10% savings. Natter, do you have some picks for us?
Yeah, I have two picks. My first pick is a book that I'm reading. It's called Shoe Dog, and it's the memoir of Phil Knight. He's the creator of Nike, and it's a lot better than I thought it would be. I've heard like multiple people tell me to read this, and I was like, nah, that doesn't sound like too good of a book or even my type of book. But after hearing it like multiple more times, I was like, okay, I'll put this on the reading list. And I got the Audible version, and it's really good. It's really interesting. It's way different than I thought it'd be. My second pick is a blog post. I'm cross-posting to Tyler McGinnis's blog. It'll be out within the next day or so. So when this comes out, you should see it. So it's on integrating GraphQL with AppSync and a React application. And it's the end-to-end application. It really goes into depth into how AppSync works in a way that I haven't done yet. And it also shows you kind of how to do some of the more sophisticated things that a lot of people are wanting to do, like offline caching, also subscriptions and things like that. So there's going to be a blog post with a fully functioning app that you can just download that kind of goes along with the blog post. So I don't know. Let me find the URL for Tyler McGinnis's blog. I think it's tylermcginnis.com. So check it out. It'll be on there under his blog.
All right, Kent, what are your picks?
Sweet. So I've got some picks for you, some that are relevant to today's discussion. So I have the blog Answers to Common Questions About Render Props, a couple of questions that people ask me pretty frequently. I also have a blog post called React's New Context API. You might be able to find it just by Googling that. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Also, I reference React Composer, which is a way to take a bunch of render prompt APIs and compose them together to a single one. It makes it a fair amount easier to deal with the nesting of render props. And then also the tweet that I mentioned, I'll make sure that's included in the show notes too, a higher order component that can do that as well. And then for my non-technical pick, I want to pick Brandon Sanderson and any book he's ever written. he's so good. So I started listening to Mistborn, the first book that I listened to from him. I fall asleep when I read. So I listen to his books. And let me just rattle off the list of books that I have been listening to since July of last year. So The Final Empire, The Well of Ascension, The Hero of Ages, that's the Mistborn series. And then there's a second Mistborn series, The Alloy of Law, Shadows of Self, The Bands of Mourning. And then I got into the Stormlight Archive, which is like an amazing series. And there are three books there, The Way of Kings, Words of Radiance, and Oathbringer. And then I also listened to Warbreaker and Edge Dancer, which are quote unquote novellas, but like still the size of Harry Potter 1 or 2. So pretty big. But then, so those are like mostly set in, you know, times with swords and you know, whatever. But then he has like some more modern stuff that are set in the United States. Steelheart, Firefight, Calamity, and Mitosis are kind of in a series. The Reckoners series, it's really, really super. And then Elantris was his first published book. It's also quite interesting. And The Rhythmatist, which is kind of a young adult novel, which is really good. But I listened to all of these in like 6 months. And to put that in perspective, these books are ridiculously long. It's 362 hours of Audible listening time. And I listen to it at like 1.8x speed. So that's like 201 hours. But that was back in January. Then since January, I've actually re-listened to the Mistborn series and started re-listening to Stormlight Archive. It's just that good. I can't give you a high enough recommendation for books by Brandon Sanderson. Really, really enjoyable books. So those are my picks.
So are those books appropriate for like children? Because me and my son actually listen to books together sometimes. We're starting to get into sci-fi stuff. So this sounds like something we might.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would probably not listen to it with anybody younger than like, a teenager myself. But there, the young adult novel, The Arithmetist, there is like a little bit of death in there and stuff. But other than that, it's like very, very clean. No even innuendos or anything like that. So yeah, it's more targeted for a younger audience. He's working on a sequel called The Atlassian, Aztlian. I'm not even sure how to say that. But anyway, so that one was super good. And each one of these has a magic system of some kind. And each one is just so very different from anything you could ever possibly imagine. There's no like wizards and warlocks or whatever. Like it's very, very unique and totally not convenient to the plot kind of magic. So like with Harry Potter, you're just like, why doesn't he just Avada Kedavra that guy and now the story's over? all of his magic systems are very scientific based. Like it all makes very like really clear sense, like why they can and can't do certain things. So it's really interesting listening or reading. So I recommend those.
Natter, if you are looking for a Brandon Sanderson series that you can listen to with your kids, Alcatraz and the Evil Librarians.
Okay.
And they are hilarious.
Awesome. Thank you.
They're written for younger audiences. That. So, yeah. I kind of go with Kent's suggestion as far as age goes. I have a 12-year-old and he's about at the point where he could kind of follow the plot lines. It's most of it's not for content. Most of it is just that, you know, the content, the plot gets a little bit involved. So, Corey, what are your picks?
Yeah, I've got a few picks here. My first one is super cool, Code Sandbox Live. If you haven't used Code Sandbox before, it's awesome. It's an online editor for React, Angular, Preact, Vue, all sorts of different things. Started out as just React. They've grown. Well, now imagine you've used Google Docs before and you can go on Google Docs and somebody else could open Google Docs on their machine and you could collaboratively edit. Well, that's basically what they've done with Code Sandbox Live, but now it's for code. So this was super exciting for me because as somebody who's often teaching software and in particular React Online, having a way for students or for other people on my team to be able to come in and interact with that code as we discuss it. And we don't have to share or trade off control. It's just we're all there collaboratively editing. Really impressive. So that's worth looking at. Another thing that I realized this week that is useful for everybody just to help connect the dots is go out and use Babel's REPL. Go click on try it out. Type out some React code and then look at what Babel spits out on the other side. And understanding that helps you understand. It's not, you know, the magic going on behind the scenes here. And you probably understand that JSX gets compiled down to React.createElement, but there's a lot of other interesting things that Babel does. So looking at the before and after is helpful. And one thing that I noticed while I was doing this was functional components are a lot smaller than class components when you look at the compiling down. Now, given this is a micro optimization and kind of a silly reason to make a decision, but it was something that caught my eye that I hadn't seen somebody point out before. So two things to consider. Another thing was I came across a React cheat sheet. So I'll share that link. Really well written, sits out on GitHub. You can read it in 20 minutes or so, but it's a really concise refresher of all the key APIs in React. Doesn't take very long and then a useful thing to check later. For my final pick, an upcoming conference where I'm speaking is in San Jose, Fluent Conference, which is a wonderful event put on by O'Reilly. I always enjoy it. Highly recommend attending. There's usually multiple sessions on all sorts of different front-end tech topics, usually a few on React as well. But I would definitely recommend attending. They tend to get really big names out there too. Like I got to meet Adi Osmani last year. I was super excited about that. So I have my own fanboys that I'm like, I got to shake your hand. This is exciting. So those are my picks.
Can I just double pick the Code Sandbox Live thing? That is like so cool.
So well done.
Double pick. That was that's very, very cool.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to do a couple of picks. Now, the first one I was just kind of looking around on Slack and Natter posted this to the React Native Radio channel that they have on the devchat.tv Slack channel for the panelists. And it was this article, "I'd Pay You $500,000 a Year, But You Can't Do the Work," by Shelley Palmer. It just looked interesting. I went and read it and I thought it was pretty good. So I'm going to pick that. I've been getting fairly involved in politics lately, and I know that about half of the U.S. just flat out disagrees with most of my politics, and the other half probably agree heartily with it. So, but I've been enjoying this book, and I think it's an interesting view on history. It's called Liars by Glenn Beck. And, anyway, it just goes into a lot of the historical information about, some of the more progressive, people in U.S. history. And yeah, it doesn't paint them in a favorable light, but I find that it's interesting just to get these views on historical people, see what they did, see how people interpret what went on, and then kind of make an informed decision. So anyway, this has been really, really interesting just to, you know, because it kind of details the progress of the progressive movement in the U.S. and where it started and how things have changed over the years. So if you're looking for, you know, something that's kind of interesting, historical, political bent, I'm going to recommend that as well. David, do you have some picks for us?
Yeah, I've got a couple at least. So the first one, and I'm going to share the link out, is the link to Ryan Florence's article on inline functions in React. I can't recommend that people doing React and considering HOCs and render props read that enough. if it can help to dispel the myth that inline functions are constantly problematic, everybody just read that article. The other one that I would the other pick I've got is related to sort of my work in the design world, and it's sort of the having been a developer for 25 years, but with a fine arts degree, sort of self-taught, I've been moving into the product design, sort of user experience, UI sort of area, especially with the company that I'm running. And so one of my favorite books is one by a user experience woman named Laura Klein. And I've got a link to it here, but it's called Building Better Products. So everybody's always saying that designers should learn how to write some code. You know, that's a flame war topic for sure. But I also am of the opinion that a lot of developers should learn more about design, because I think it helps influence how you look at building an application or a product and keeping it user-centered and keeping it simple, and will help to reduce a lot of the complexity there. But yeah, Building Better Products by Laura Klein for sure.
Awesome. David, if people want to see what you're working on these days or follow you on a blog or Twitter or GitHub or anything like that, where do they go?
They can reach me at Tuxor on Twitter, TUXZ0R. And I've got a GitHub account. I occasionally put things up there. I've got a lot of really crummy code pens sitting around because I play around with ideas on code pen a lot. But now that everybody's talking about code sandbox, especially the live stuff, I'm going to have to give that a try. But yeah, basically Twitter and GitHub are the places you'll find me most. And I occasionally try to post articles out on Medium, either as myself or under Tandemly, which is the company I run.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap this one up. Thanks for coming, David.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, we will catch everyone next week.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.